When is your sister expecting her baby?
February. And she might have a baby shower in January. Mm. I think after Tampa, I'll drop in there.
So you can drop off on the way back?
Yeah. February. Baby's coming.
What?
Baby's coming.
Girl or boy, they know?
Girl.
Oh. That's her first, right?
First.
Brief Eternity by Dr. Robert Fuchsberger. It was some day in September 1946, that memorable year when I first experienced the guidance of Bhagavan. I was walking through the park in the town, carrying a periodical in which I had just read an article explaining that the after-death state, that in the after-death state, there is no reasoning faculty, but just pure consciousness. I walked along slowly, pondering over this, and wondering what such a state would be like. Suddenly I lost my normal consciousness, the thinking and discriminating faculty stopped, there was total release from the world of the senses and of thoughts, the eye disappeared, leaving neither subject nor object, there was no past or future, only the eternal now. What I experienced was only consciousness. A consciousness without qualifications or limitations. There was simply being, and this being was aware. It was not a void, because it was vibrant with peace and bliss. How long this state lasted, I don't know, because it was beyond space and time. When I regained human consciousness, I was standing in front of a grassy bank. How I had got there, I didn't know, and was not interested to ask. I simply sat down and beheld all nature surprisingly vivid and alive. I knew without the least doubt what state it was that I had caught a glimpse of. I was aware, and it was bliss. That is it was the state of Satchitananda, which is the egoless state that Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi speaks of. I was not at all surprised by this experience. It seemed quite natural. It was only later that I began to wonder at all at it, perceiving that, by some incredible grace, I had been vouchsafed a pre-glimpse of realization at the very outset of my course of self-inquiry. It was a glimpse of what I had to strive for all my life. Standing at the foot of the mountain, I had caught a momentary view of the summit, when the clouds parted. In the ensuing years, I only once again had such an experience. I was lying on the grass one fine summer day and watching the white clouds float past, when suddenly clouds and sky and the whole universe disappeared, and again my mundane consciousness was transcended. Grass had a lot to do with this. not that type of field. Quote from Rumi, "How should thankfulness arise from possessions and riches? Thankfulness arises from trials and sickness." This one is all about suffering. The Suffering of a Realized Man, Alan Chadwick. The first question I asked Bhagavan after I came to Tiruvannamalai was why Christ cried out upon the cross. If he was a perfect realized man, then surely he would have been indifferent to suffering, I argued. You know, he was in the last year of his divinity studies in Oxford, and he quit. And the one professor he had at that time, which my friend had done research on, why he trying to figure out why he quit, mm-hmm. he had written a book about, you know, Christ's godhood being questioned because of this particular incident.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that Chadwick may have been disillusioned about Christ, right. You know, as God, as his mm-hmm. father who was a minister and grandfather who was a minister,
yeah.
and he was following in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And where did he go when he got disillusioned? Canada.
Oh, yeah.
He went up to Saskatchewan and became a surveyor.
Oh.
And then the World War I broke out, and he had some military training in college. So he went back and joined, became a lieutenant. Mm. So that's the one first question he asked Bhagavan. So that goes back to those days when he was young. Bhagavan explained that although there can be no suffering for one who has attained liberation, it may happen, in some cases, that they appear to feel pain. This is only the reaction of the body, for the body still has its reactions. It still eats and performs its natural functions, but it only seems to the onlooker that it is the realized man himself who is suffering. He himself would no longer say so, since he no longer identified himself with the body that suffers. Also, it is immaterial to him when and where he leaves the body. Some may appear to suffer when dying. Others may die in samadhi while unaware of the outer world. Still, others may just disappear from sight at the moment of death. This explanation is especially interesting in view of what happened in the case of Bhagavan during his last days. He certainly appeared to suffer terribly. At night, he lay upon the bed groaning and calling out, and it was indeed difficult to grasp that he was a realized man who did not feel pain in the same way that we do, who saw it as something apart from him, as a dream which he could regard objectively. Now, he's the only one that wrote this, that Bhagavan, you know, groaned and everything. Because when the crowds came and everything, he was always controlled everything. He didn't let that come out.
Yeah.
Not many people saw that or knew about that.
Yeah. Sri Nagama said he looked to be in terrible suffering.
Yeah, but not groaning and calling out, like you're saying here. Mm-hmm. With body, you know, they said that type of sarcoma, cancer. Doctor said it's like you're lying down in a truck rolling over your arm. And yet, when he was giving darshan to devotees during the daytime, he would smile graciously to them, and there was no indication of suffering in him. When he was obliviously or obviously in agony, he was asked if he did not feel pain. No, he replied, but there is pain. Pain was there for the body. If one identifies oneself with the body, one feels it and believes that one has pain. But for the realized man who always sees the body as something apart from himself, pain is only a witnessed experience outside his reality. There is pain, but somehow it is not his. And Joel Goldsmith, big article on the unreality of evil. this Anthony who comes here, you know, he knows all about Joel Goldsmith.
Yeah.
I don't know if you met him or what. He comes here once a week.
Anthony is the one that's been coming more lately.
Right? Yeah, he comes once a week. Every day Friday. Off. He's a doorman somewhere. Yes. Yeah.
Every Friday he comes.
Yeah.
You know, he was a school teacher for a little bit when he was younger.
Yeah.
After he got out of college.
He was a bartender too.
Yeah, he told me, I didn't save up. That's why I have to be a doorman. You don't do that.
What did he say?
He didn't save up.
He didn't save money.
He didn't save money. Yeah.
So he was advising me.
I think he came to the ashram years ago.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Like on 6th Street.
On 6th Street, yeah.
I don't remember him though, do you?
Yeah, I remember him vaguely. When he told me, I remembered him.
He remembers you.
Yeah.
Had long ago.
Yeah. Tears of Sympathy by T.P. Ramachandra Iyer. I met him, this fellow. Sri Bhagavan showed interest in reading the lives of saints. And whenever he came across a moving passage in them, he would shed tears. He delighted us all by reading out passages from such books, but whenever moving passages came, his voice would be choked, and he would struggle to keep up his normal voice. I remember one particular instance. Sri Bhagavan was reading the life of Saint Kanapa. At a particular stage, he began to weep and stopped reading, saying, impossible to read further, impossible. You know the story of Kanapa? He was like a tribal person, you know, and you know, they used to hunt and everything. Mm-hmm. He was the son of the king of the tribe, mm-hmm. and expected to become the next king. But he went out with a band of his fellow friends, and they went into a forest, and they saw a Shiva Linga in the forest up on a hill, and surrounded. And somehow he just got fascinated. He told everyone to go back, I'm going to stay here. And he started offering meat. He would cook meat and offer it to the Shiva Linga. That's all he knew, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, so there was a Brahmin priest who used to come once a day and do a puja at that shrine mm-hmm. in the forest. And he would see these meat things there, you know what I mean? He would be like disgusted, he'd clearing it all out every day and, you know, and doing his puja. And then, he would carry that Kanapa would carry water for putting it in his mouth and blow it on this, you know, he had no idea, but he was irresistibly attracted. He couldn't stop. He stayed there every day and just did the worship. So the priest hid one day, trying to find out behind some bush, and he saw that Kanapa. He was doing what he did, you know, and putting him up, he was like shocked. And then one of the eyes of the Shiva Lingam started bleeding. Oh. And Kanapa got all excited, you know, tried to stop the bleeding, but he couldn't stop it. So he pulled out his eyeball and put it there. Oh. You know what I mean? Oh. And then the other one started bleeding. Oh. Then he went to pull out his other eyeball, dig it out, to put it onto the Shiva Linga. And he put his foot on the spot he's supposed to put it, because he pulls it out, he can't see.
Oh, okay.
He put his foot on the lingam on the thumb. And right then the Lord appeared and said, stop.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then that Brahmin was seeing all this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then that Brahmin came out, you know, and prostrated before the Kanapa.
Oh.
Because of you, I have had the vision.
Oh.
And all this, you know. They built a temple there. There's a shrine there. It's still there at that spot.
Where is this?
What?
Where is this?
Santama Nadoi. You can read the Parayapuranam story.
Oh.
You know, most of these Parayapuranam stories of these 63 saints,
yeah.
Most of them aren't Brahmins. You know, they're all like lower caste people, but, you know, taken up with, you know, this intense one point of devotion. So Bhagavan was reading that and he couldn't control himself.
In devotion.
Yeah. You can read in the Parayapuranam. So Saint Kanapa, at the particular stage, he began to weep and stopped reading, saying, "Impossible to read further, impossible." There have been seen several other occasions when Bhagavan was moved to tears, even when individuals narrated their sad stories or afflictions. I was surprised at first how Bhagavan could be affected by afflictions on the physical plane. I did ask him once about it. Sri Bhagavan said, "Why not? It is the swabhava of the sarira, the nature of the body, to react to pleasures and pains. The reactions stop at the body level." He then continued, "If you throw a stone at the head of a saint, why should you not expect the head to break and bleed? Natural consequences are bound to take place. Does it make any difference to the saints? He, however, gave us to understand that such reactions in a jnani were only on the body level and never affected him inwardly as we were affected." This is one I met also, the Diya Sastri. This is "How I Came to the Maharshi" by Diya Sastri. "I had my first darshan of Bhagavan in May 1941. That's about the time Bhagavan heard of 1941. "I happened to be in Madras at the time on my way from Cochin to Ahmedabad on transfer and was awaiting the arrival of my personal effects by train." He was a bank manager. This is that Suri Nagama's brother.
Oh,
the letters from him. He translated all those letters to English. "As I was mentally worried over that transfer and was brooding over it, it occurred to me that I should go over to Tiruvannamalai to see the great Maharshi and obtain some solace from him. Some years before that, a friend of mine had asked me to accompany him to the ashram, but somehow I did not feel attracted. Earlier in my life, my experience of so-called holy men had been unfortunate, so I developed a prejudice. Subsequently, I visited several temples in South India, but could not find any solace. But when I suggested to my wife that we should visit the ashram, she readily agreed, and we started for Tiruvannamalai one fine morning. By the time we reached the ashram, it was past 11:30 a.m. All was quiet. The ashramites had lunch and were resting. An attendant at the guest house took us into the kitchen, and we had our lunch there. We were told that we could have Bhagavan's darshan only at 2:30. Having nothing particular to do, I strayed into the bookstall, told the attendant the purpose of our visit, and sat there reading one of the books for sale. At that time, there was no room behind the bookstall. Instead, there was a window opposite the main door. A little before 2:30, while returning from the bathroom at the eastern end of the ashram, Bhagavan stopped at the window to talk to someone who happened to be there. The bookstall attendant pointed him out to me. A thrill went through my whole body. What a difference from the swamis and the holy men I had seen before. That lustrous body, those shining eyes, that beauteous smile, that gentle speech and halting gait, all took me completely by surprise. I got up and slowly went into the hall. Bhagavan was there, seated on the couch, looking tenderly at all the devotees there. On entering the hall, the ego in me did not permit my prostrating before him. Instead, I just folded my hands by way of namaskar and sat down, watching critically all that was happening. People were coming and going, and not a word was spoken. Everybody appeared happy and contented. The prevailing scene, or the prevailing serene atmosphere, was infectious. I sat motionless. I had nothing to ask. I was lost in wonder and admiration at the peace and silence. The thought uppermost in my mind was, if people could be happy thus, with a minimum of food and clothing, why not I? Why these worldly possessions and the struggles incidental thereto? Why grieve about official worries and domestic calamities? At 4:45 p.m., Bhagavan left the hall as usual and came back later for Veda Parayana, which was arranged in the open space adjacent to the hall. The chanting of the Vedic hymns began in those idyllic surroundings with Arunachala on one side and the flower garden on the other, and with Bhagavan, wearing only a loincloth, sitting in the midst of the devotees. I felt as if I was in another world altogether. It was only when the chanting was over and devotees began leaving that I realized I was in this mundane world. Raja, the postmaster, did you meet him? Was he still there in 82?
I'm not sure I remember.
You wouldn't know because he would go around and give everyone their mail, you know. Raja, the postmaster, told me that ladies were not allowed to stay overnight in the ashram and that I should seek an abode elsewhere. At my request, he fixed up for the night a house under construction in the compound of Mahastan. Now the ashram has ample accommodation for visitors, editor. After an early evening meal, my wife went to the house for rest while I stayed on in the ashram for supper at 7:30 with Bhagavan in the dining hall. After supper, I was reluctant to leave the ashram as I wanted to have more of Bhagavan. On inquiry, someone told me that Bhagavan might sit out for a while that night as it was very sultry. Month of May. Mm. Pretty hot time. Have you been in Pondicherry, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I've been in May. Too, so. It's probably more humid there, right?
It's very humid. Yeah. By the sea.
In Pondicherry.
Pondicherry. Yeah. I've never felt that heat.
Oh, Bombay even, right?
Yeah, not Bombay
is not that hot. Yeah. Okay. I therefore stayed on. Bhagavan came back after a short walk, and I sat on an easy chair in the open space between the hall and the well. A few devotees sat around him. One of them asked Bhagavan about an incident in Yoga Vasishta. Instead of just explaining it, Bhagavan began narrating the whole story at length. The pleasant way he spoke, the simple language he used, and the dignified manner in which he related the story captivated our hearts and kept us all spellbound. At the end of it, the devotees told me that I was particularly lucky because Bhagavan rarely spoke much or for such a long time. I felt extremely happy and gratified. That night, my wife and I compared notes. We were fully agreed that we had reached our haven and found our real guru. The mental satisfaction we could not get by our visits to temples or to other holy men, we had got in abundance in the ashram. We therefore stayed on for some more days. Thus began our attachment to Bhagavan and the ashram. Here's How the Maharshi Came to Me by G. N. Daly. She writes a lot of articles in here.
Yeah.
She just wrote one on, you know, on this Father Pio.
On what?
Her name, Padre Pio. Of Petrelcina, you know, Italian priest, or saint. There's it. And I thought on Amazon, there's a story there. Padre Pio. You know, he had the stigmata. Mm-hmm. You know, like some others, like St. Francis.
Yeah.
They have some movie of them. How the Maharshi Came to Me by G.N. Daly. When about 20 years of age, I began an intensive process of self-interrogation, and after about 12 months, had divorced body and mind from consciousness. Body plus mind equals space and time. Consciousness equals no space and now. This was not realization, however. It was purely conceptual understanding. I did not follow the ego consciousness back to its source. So the quest went on, reading, meditating, and experiencing. Some 20 years later, in 1954, after many a headache and heartache, to put it mildly, I came upon Arthur Osborne's newly published Ramana Maharshi and the Path of Self-Knowledge. This started a new era in my life.
That was the first book I read, too.
Is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
First one I read was Day by Day. You read the first book about Ramana?
Collected Works.
Collected Works. She went right into it. We needed some story. Thus, this started a new era in my life. Shortly after reading it, I wrote to the ashram at Tiruvannamalai and bought a few books. My interest in Bhagavan and his direct path grew steadily for a few years, but then certain difficulties which I encountered put a complete end to all personal activities. The next 7 years were a complete blank, with no free time to read, think, or act for myself. Everything had to be dropped to cope with the circumstances. She must have got a job. But Bhagavan never let go. On August 13, 1966, His grace descended on me like a lightning flash. I cannot describe the nature of it. That can only be experienced. I can only describe the way in which it was bestowed and the nature of the awakening which it brought about. It came upon me in one of those dreams which are not the result of mental activity, but which one recognizes when one wakes from them as direct experience or communication. In the dream, I was standing at the head of a bus queue. When the bus arrived, it did not stop where I was standing, but a few yards away, so that those who were at the end of the queue were the first to get in, and I was the last. You experienced that in Mumbai?
Yes. Always.
When I first went to Bombay, maybe in the 70s, I was surprised how orderly these bus stands and the trains and everything were running and organized. Oh, yeah. I don't know about now, but back then, everybody quietly sat in line. Nobody, you know, when the bus went, they didn't just rush in and, you know, like they do in other places, in Tamil Nadu and Bihar.
Even here they do that.
What?
Even here they do that.
Oh, I see them on the hillside standing in line.
You know. In line in Manhattan. I mean, they just come in a clump and go.
But if there's a lot of people waiting, they make a queue, right, for the one bus.
Yeah, they still make a queue.
They still make a queue, yeah. So then she was in she got in, I was the last to get in. By the time I did get in, all the seats were occupied, and I had to stand in the middle of the gangway between the two rows of seats. Several people who had been standing near me in the queue seeing this, began to protest that I ought to have a seat, all speaking together. It was in the midst of this hubbub that Bhagavan's grace struck hard and decisively, completely silent and formless. This body I called mine, in which my consciousness was still functioning as my ego, suddenly changed and grew taller, broader, and sturdier. I was also aware of a change in features, and the gentle smile of Bhagavan was superimposed on the face. The physical changes were accompanied by an experience of pure universal consciousness and bliss. In the first few moments of this beingness, a few thoughts lightly crossed the mind. How can I tell these people that I am here? How can I possibly explain this to them? What does it matter if I sit in the front seat or at the back or just stand in the middle? I am here now. Bliss and beingness were both inside and outside the body. Then these thoughts subsided, leaving only the bliss of pure awareness. I'm quite unable to describe the reality of this experience of Bhagavan's grace. It did not matter where I was, because I am includes both space and time. Whether Bhagavan's consciousness entered mine, or whether he drew mine into his, I do not know. Only that Bhagavan was experienced within, and that he is still within me now. Implicit in his grace were also instruction, initiation, and obligation. The instruction was to continue being, and the initiation was in the beingness. The sharing or the joining of his consciousness with mine, the obligation lies in assisting others who may need help or guidance. Oh, that's, I don't know.
It's Christian.
Christian, yeah. So strong is the I current now that a certainty has arisen that I was never born. And if this question is referred to the mind, the answer which arises, how can you have been born? You are now, and you always were, and always will be now. The following analogy may further explain the nature of his grace. Consider us all to be satellites in orbit around the center, the heart. Then suppose one of these, by Bhagavan's guidance, slows down until a spiraling motion sets in. Then by his grace it stops, dead in its track, and plummets right into the center. After having there absorbed his grace, it is free once more to return into orbit, but in doing so no longer sees the heart as being exclusively in the center, but in itself also, and in all the others who are orbiting the center. In fact, the heart is everywhere. Then there's a poem by Arthur Osborne, The Elixir of Youth. The frosty years have in their grip this ailing body that at last into death's refuse bend must slip. Then let it go, quick be it or slow, like autumn flower and wintry blast. For I have drunk youth's elixir, his joy made firm, his follies fled. Life, like a May Day cloister, throbs into song, the heart grown strong, dances and sings where grief lies dead. This world and body are not me. They are a dream from which to awake. Whatever in their fate may be, cannot destroy the vibrant joy or turn the night the bright daybreak. When even imperfect sight can bring such joyful certitude as this, who to the seeming self would cling in a barren land where no birds sing, lost to awareness being bliss? Quote from Bhagavan. Meditation is initiated and sustained by a conscious effort of the mind. When such effort entirely subsides, it is called samadhi. Here's chapter 6 of the Bhagavad Gita.
Is this still on suffering?
Yeah. But I didn't read all those suffering articles.
Oh, okay.
Chapter 6, verse 1, Bhagavad Gita. He it is who is a sannyasi, he it is who is a yogi, who performs his duty without regard to profit, not he who renounces the sacred fire and activity of a householder. 2. Know that which is called renunciation to be in fact yoga, O son of Pandu, for none becomes a yogi without renouncing sankalpa. No. Sankalpa, a word frequently used in this chapter, is wider in its meaning than desire. It is any mental preoccupation and may be ambition, projects, or imagination. 3. For the wise, muni, aspirant to yoga, action is said to be the way. After he has attained, stillness is said to be the way. Note, Shankara interprets Shammaha, here rendered stillness, a cessation of all activity, quoting a passage from the Mahabharata. Tilak takes it to be serenity and calls it the means of continued action. 4. When a man is attached neither to sense objects nor to actions, but has renounced all sankalpa, he is said to have attained yoga. 5. Let a man raise himself, let him not debase himself, for he himself is his friend, he himself his foe. The Sanskrit word atma, like the English self, can mean either the Supreme Self, Paramatma, or the individual self, Jivatma. It is used in this verse and the next without either prefix. 6. To him who has subdued the self by the self is the friend. But to him of uncontrolled self, the self remains hostile, like an enemy. 7. In one who is self-controlled and serene, the self remains equipoised in heat and cold, pleasure and pain, even in honor and dishonor. 8. The yogi is said to be integrated, who is content with knowledge and wisdom, unshaken and master of his senses, and to whom a clod, a stone, and a piece of gold are the same. 9. Preeminent is he who looks with equal eye on the well-disposed, the friend and foe, the neutral and indifferent, the estranged and related, the righteous and the unrighteous. 10. Sitting alone in solitude, the yogi should meditate with body and mind controlled, free from desire and possessiveness. Note, up to here, whenever the word yoga has been used in the Gita to denote a particular path, it has been the path of disinterested activity, what would today be called karma marga. In this and the following verses, it is used for the first time to denote the type of path which is today called yoga. You have to rewrite that for these days, right? Practical, you know.
Yeah.
11. He should assume a firm posture, asana, in a clean place, neither too high nor too low, on kusha grass covered with a deer skin and a cloth. No, kusha is a sacred grass. A deer skin is used because, being a non-conductor, it prevents the electric currents generated in the body from escaping into the ground. 12. Seated there with concentrated mind, thoughts and senses under control, he should practice yoga to purify himself. 13. With body, head and neck erect, motionless, gazing at the tip of the nose and not looking about. 14. Serene and fearless, let him sit firm in his vow of celibacy, with mind controlled and turned to me, integrated and intent on me alone. 15. Thus, ever at one, the yogi of controlled mind attains to the supreme peace of nirvana, which is in me. 16. Yoga is not for one who eats too much or fasts too much, Arjuna, nor for one who sleeps too much or wakes too much. 17. But for one who is a yogi in his eating and recreation, a yogi in his activities, a yogi in his sleeping and his waking, yoga becomes the destroyer of suffering. Note, in this verse, the adjective yuktaha, derived from the same root as yoga, is taken by most translators to mean moderate. Professor Kulkarni explains in a note given at the end of the chapter why he prefers to take it as meaning in a yogic manner. 18. When the perfectly controlled mind rests in the self alone, free from all desires, then is one said to be integrated, yuktaha. 19. To a lamp in a windless place, which does not flicker, is compared a yogi of concentrated mind meditating on the self. 20. When the mind, disciplined by yogic practice, attains quietude, and when, seeing the self through the self, one is content with the self. 21. When one knows that infinite bliss, which can be grasped by the intellect, buddhi, but is beyond the senses, and established in it, never stirs from truth, no, or from reality. The same Sanskrit word can be translated as either. Only reality is true. Only truth is real. 22. Which, having attained, one conceives of no higher gain, and which established, one is not moved even by great grief. 23. Then can one know that this severance, viyoga, from union with suffering is called union yoga. In this yoga, should one persevere with undesponding mind. 24, 25. Giving up every single desire born of sankalpa and completely restraining the sense organ by the mind from every outlet, one should gradually attain quietude with the intellect, buddhi, held steadfast, and the mind sunk in the self, allowing no thought to arise. 26. To whatever side the restless, unsteady mind wanders away, one should check it and bring it back, controlled, to the self. Bhagavan quotes that verse a lot. Mm-hmm. People can't, so they complain they can't control the mind. So there's an instruction you have to keep doing. 27. To such a yogi as this, tranquil in mind, passion-free, sinless, and one with Brahman, comes supreme bliss. 28. Thus engaging constantly in yoga and free from sin, the yogi easily attains the infinite bliss of contact with Brahman. 29. One who is thus integrated in yoga, yoga yukta atma, sees all with equal eye, seeing himself in all beings, and all beings in himself. Note, or the self. See the note on verse 5. 30. One who sees me everywhere, and sees all in me, I shall not be lost to him, nor he to me. 31. That yogi who, established in oneness, worships me and all beings, dwells in me, though active in all ways. 32. He who looks everywhere with equal eye, Arjuna, and regards the pleasure and pain of others as his own, is considered a perfect yogi. 33. Arjuna said, this yoga of equanimity which you teach, O slayer of Madhu, seems to me to have no firm endurance, owing to restlessness of the mind. 34. For the mind, O Krishna, is restless and turbulent, strong and obstinate, as hard it is to control, I believe, as the wind. 35. Sri Bhagavan said, undoubtedly, O mighty arm, the mind is hard to control and restless, but by practice and dispassion, avyasa and vairagya, it can be controlled, O son of Kunti. For one who cannot control himself, yoga is hard to master, I admit. But for the self-control, there are ways to master it.